Blog Talk Radio.
Have you ever wondered why it's happening again?
Welcome to Mind Shifters Radio with your co-host, the Forgiveness Doctor, Dr. Michael Rice, and his wife, Jeannie. Michael and Jeannie share with you the wisdom of the ancient Aramaic internal process of forgiveness. They offer tools and support 5 days a week. They will support you in building a solid foundation within yourself to live in pure love. In Aramaic, Rachma. Michael is the author of Why Is This Happening to Me Again? For more information on Michael and Jeannie, please visit www.whyagain.com. And now your co-host, the Forgiveness Doctor, Dr. Michael and Jeannie Rice.
To the brightness within you and the truth that is rooted within me.
Hi, and welcome to Mind Shifters Radio with the Forgiveness Doctor, Dr. Michael Rice. I'm your co-host, Jeannie Rice, and we want to welcome you to the show. Today is Friday, December the 5th, 2014, and our calling number is 646-200-4169. Press 1, and that puts you in queue to talk to us. And we would love to hear your comments and your questions, because that makes this your show. And I apologize for those that are trying to get in the chat room. I'm actually trying to get in the door so I can turn my computer on. And as soon as I get in there and we get the chat room open, then you will be able to get in there and comment and all that good stuff. Dr. Dale. I do that all the time. I'm so used to saying Dr. Dale. So anyway, I'll get you turned on here in just a moment. In the meantime, let me hand you over to Michael, and I'll get the chat room going. Welcome, Michael.
Thank you, dear heart, and welcome everybody to the show. We're delighted and honored to have this space to share with you. Cool here in Wilmington, North Carolina today, although it's a gorgeous sunny day. We are appreciative of the fact that you choose to join us, because each person who chooses to join us assists and helps in advancing the understanding of the first century Aramaic process of forgiveness on planet Earth. And as we join in doing that, we create critical mass. We create a shift. And the shift that happens is the shift into human life, the shift into the active presence of love that we are each designed to function out of. So we are just honored that you choose to join us. We had another awesome evening last night here at Unity of Wilmington. We've got one more night, so if you want to join us, come and play tonight, 7 o'clock. We'll be doing Laws of Living and touching into the ancient Aramaic idea that law has nothing to do with what the world tells you, as usual. Law has to do not with the rule of a superior, not with something to be obeyed, but rather it has to do with eternal forces that are to be coordinated with. And when you coordinate with them, then you're living inside of the laws of living. And as long as you think they're rules that somebody else lays down for you to follow, you'll find yourself obedient to kings or disobedient to kings and finding yourself in trouble. So we're here to straighten out that whole dilemma of the mixing up of words and the turning of the key ideas of healing around backward and bringing them back to the truth of what we're designed for. We are designed to live human lives. Question becomes, well, Michael, define a human life for us. The definition is easy. Hold the newborn child, you know exactly what a human life is. If you don't have one of those, I don't mean a newborn child. I mean, if you don't have the active presence of love in your mind, in your body, then you've been tricked into thinking you're living a human life when you're not. What we're here to do is to support you having this awesome active presence of love that you're designed for, functional in your physiology 24/7, 365. And that's what we're here to learn. That's what we're here to teach. That's what we're here to support you in. So we're just delighted that you're here. And Jeannie, is Dr. Kim with us today?
Well, I haven't got there yet, but I do have Dale on. But you need to put your earphones on because it's definitely muffled. While I was talking, Julie actually texted me and said that she couldn't hardly understand me. So I will get Dale turned on. Yes, Dr. Kim is with us as well. So I've got him turned on.
Let's say hello to Dr. Kim, then we'll pull Dale into the play.
Well, I'm doing well. I was just going to say the same thing. I was coming over to the computer to log in because things were getting a little staticky, but I'm doing very well. I'm looking forward to an Aramaic Friday. I was very aware that we didn't have Dale with us last week, and I'm looking forward to hearing him again and hearing how he's doing and hearing about his latest endeavors. He's going to do a Mary Magdala Isis thing, and so let's get him in here, and you can hear me all 5 days a week. Let's hear Dale.
Hello. Am I there?
You are.
Hi, Dale. You're
hey, Dale,
here.
How do you do?
Yeah, last week I had it central in my mind about the show, and then I got into, like, making flyers and press releases and things like that, and then I looked at the clock. It was 2:21, and I was like, totally and completely. Actually, it was Jeannie texted me at 2:21 was what it was, and I was like, ah. It was right there in the front of my mind, and then I got so deep into all that, it just went by. But anyway, right now I'm actually in North Carolina. Of course, that's where I live, but I'm in the passenger seat. We're on our way to Williamsburg, Virginia. Like, Loretta's driving, and the kids are in the back seat, and we're en route. So I do, though.
You're taking the whole family this trip.
Yeah, which is a whole, it's great in a lot of ways, but it's definitely a forgiveness sort of intensive in itself sometimes. It's been going well, though. But, of course, we've only been on the road about 3 hours. So, but anyway, yeah, I wanted to let everybody know, because I've been getting some messages from people, like, about next year, will I be doing Aramaic Fridays next year? I just want to, like, just come out to let everybody know that I will not. So I've got four weeks left. So if you've got questions or something you want to get in, this is the 4 weeks. My focus next year is going to be completely on the pre-launch. Well, first the crowdfunding, and then the pre-launch of the book, and then the book launch itself, and then the actual tour, promotional tours, and all that. I've got a pretty intensive schedule. It looks beautiful, though. My signed on with a tour manager who's, like, really got me circling, and it looks great, actually. I'm really excited. A lot of places I haven't been before, so 2016 is definitely going to be my most active time, and I'm eager to get the book out. And I just talked with the recording studio today where I'm going to be doing the audiobook, and the audiobook's going to have, it's also going to have a special meditation CD that's not going to be available anywhere else, so people will be able to get the book and the audiobook in a package, and have, like, a whole extra sort of added nuance that they won't get anywhere else. So I'm really looking forward to it. But right now I'm in the middle of all the details of, like, editing and the final edits and things like that, and artwork and things. So, but I'm excited. It's going to be a big year.
Sounds very exciting. Why don't you share the title of the book and give us a little bit of a taste so that we can get prepped for it and get people ready to do the pre-order launch?
Well, it'll be out in the beginning of May. I haven't set the exact date. Actually, I have set the exact date. I just don't remember what it was, but it's called Echoes of an Ancient Dream. And the book is really the core, the first, I've talked about it a couple times on the show. After the foreword, the book actually starts at Heartland with me digging through a box of cassettes at Eternity, at Eternal Support, back in 95, and hearing Rocco Errico tone the Lord's Prayer and speak it, at least, and then my experience with starting with toning and working with the words themselves. But the book, I mean, the real theme of the book, it's in three sections. The first section is kind of my personal experiences of working with those teachings and, like, the sort of some of the biases that I encountered from what you would call, you know, the accepted, accredited, established scholarly realm, and pretty much some fairly common, pretty intensive biases that people have about it that sometimes even take the form of attacks on credibility or things like that, because I chose not to sort of walk down that path. The second section is me taking some of the teachings that we know the most, just a few words and phrases, and unpacking them in Aramaic, laying the Greek next to it, and putting some Latin in there, and talking about some of the translational issues we've had in 2,000 years. And then the third section is really a very deeply experiential aspect of toning some of the basic words of Jesus, some of the ancient Aramaic words and sounds. Toning is something that I love because it gets you into an experience of it, and even if you don't even know what the word means, it really opens the heart up and gets you in out of the head space and into the heart space. And the ultimate is when you can get into the balance between the heart and the head, because, you know, as I say, you know, one of the interesting aspects of the first section of the book is me talking about the intensity of bias that I've encountered over the past couple of decades of, you know, even, and I know, you know, not that Michael's ever heard any of this before, but because I hadn't gone through pre-established channels, accepted channels, to learn a lot of this, that I tend to go off the path and actually make my own choices rather than just, blindly eating up what's served. I've come to a lot of conclusions that wouldn't have happened if I had been preconditioned and indoctrinated first. So it's almost exactly like if I was a native Aramaic speaker, I wouldn't see in the language and in the teachings what I would see if that was my native language. Just like me in English, the average person who speaks English doesn't have a clue of what a lot of the words even mean. They don't know anything of the history of how the pronunciations changed and the meanings changed. They just know it was, you could say, served up on a plate to them in schools and colleges, high school, college, elementary school, and grammar class. And I was stunned when I really got deep into the language of just the English language. I was stunned at how what I was learning in history or in language classes in English class in high school that I was told was the way it was. These are the laws of grammar. I was stunned when I found out that many of those supposed laws of grammar were just made up by people who hadn't actually studied the actual history of the English language and what a lot of the words meant and a lot of the pronunciations, like why there's an E on the end of the word name and things like that. I was stunned when I actually studied the history of the language, English alone, and I was like, oh my God, somebody made up these laws of grammar. It was exactly that with Aramaic. When I would read the sort of dyed-in-the-wool, die-hard scholar types, I'm able to appreciate that. But the one thing I notice is that there's really intense, thick walls that are built up around the ideologies and the BS, you know, the belief systems. And that literally, that dogma, the intensity of that belief becomes, it boils down and hardens to become a barrier to the very direct experience of what it was that the teachings, I believe, are pointing toward in the first place. Exactly like Michael said in the opening about Rahma, about that open space of conscious, active, present love. So now I'm able to, you know, if I feel that someone is somehow trying to call the credibility of my work into question or whoever's work, I can view it in a very open space and know that it won't be about how I jump back with all kinds of information that's going to really make a difference to anyone. What's going to be is, can I reply, can I respond responsibly with that within a space of conscious, active, present love without attaching that intense hostility and judgment and fear onto what it is that I'm saying. So the way it turns out for me is you judge the tree by the fruit. So hopefully for people through the book, they're going to get that my heart, I do my best to keep my heart completely open in the work. And I really want people to know that if you feel some sort of hostility or fear or hatred or criticism, whatever it may be coming from someone, even if it's me or Michael or about our work, remember, judge the tree by the fruit. If someone can't do it consciously, just maintain your own responsibility to keep your heart open and realize it's about the open heart. It's not about the knowledge in terms of what we know in our heads, because today's facts are tomorrow's fodder. A lot of people don't realize that much of what we think on, you know, today in a couple of weeks will be nullified. And that's the way I seek to live my life. It's just judging or opening up and sort of cracking down my own biases that I may have, whatever my blind spots are. And that's really what the book is about, is opening up the heart of the teachings from the experiential aspect and realize that the finger is not the moon. So it's about being the moon.
So, Dale, what you're really telling us is that this is a book written by a heretic.
Oh, of course it is. Yes.
And, of course, few people recognize the meaning of the word heretic means choice, someone with choice. And that when you don't go through the regular channels, you're not brainwashed and channeled into thinking a certain way, and therefore you can step outside and get back to the real thing. And, you know, we look in just about every arena of so-called education, and there's little or no education there. What we've got is an indoctrination program, and when you get indoctrinated to thinking a certain way about certain things, tough to break out of those channels, because the truth is it isn't even thinking. It's just thinking we're thinking. And so congratulations. I'm excited and look forward to seeing that book when it comes out.
That's big what you just said. It's not really thinking. It's thinking that we're thinking. It's just the resonance of past belief systems, and that's really the focus. It's the core of what Echoes of an Ancient Dream is about, the book. It's about realizing that it's as much about the echo or the reflection that's happening in our own consciousness, our own being, as it is about the actual thing itself, the teaching, whatever it may be. And if you're still looking at someone outside or facts outside or some sort of beliefs or proof or evidence outside without being able to bring that into the open space of the heart, then you're still walking dead. You still are not living a life. You're just sort of remotely, or should I say rotely, unconsciously regurgitating the past, thinking that you're thinking rather than actually thinking. And I really want to encourage people to know, hey, what you thought when you were 7 years old when you first read the Bible is just as valid as someone who is an expert in theology at the age of 80 or 90 that's been within whatever particular church for 60 or 70 years. It's just as valid, if not more valid, to keep that heart open and listen to what a young child would say in response, because then it would show us our blind spots. But when we boil it down and become an expert, the heart closes and forget it. It's over. You're not actually alive. You're just regurgitating beliefs.
It's interesting, Dale. David Joseph Bohm, physicist, cohort of Einstein, I love one of his quotes. He says, most people, when they think, think they're thinking and are merely rearranging their prejudices.
That's good. Yeah,
and that,
you know,
and that goes back like to the 50s.
Yeah, I mean, I've gotten a lot from Bohm, from Niels Bohr, a lot of the early quantum guys, and of course Einstein. It's amazing because even Albert Einstein is a guy who said, I want to know the thoughts of God, the rest are details, or I want to know the mind of God. But what's interesting is even he admitted later in his life, when some of the quantum theory was coming out, how a particle can be in two places at the same time, traveling at different intensities of velocity, of speed. He called it woo-woo physics. He couldn't hack it, and he was actually saying this can't be true, because if it is true that we're not bound within these certain laws of physics, then it questions everything I've ever put out there. And that was an interesting, beautiful moment of vulnerability, was that Einstein was able to keep his heart open, and a lot of people don't realize that the real intensity of his creativity only really happened within a 15-month period that a lot of his greatest things, theories, popped out. And then for a long portion, for the last decades of his life, he stayed fairly quiet because he felt that he was totally and completely out of his league, which I don't think that he was. I think if he could have let go of what his beliefs were, he could have probably been a huge light that went forward, but he felt like he was out of his league because he said, while I want to know the thoughts of God, in some ways they terrify me. And I thought that vulnerability was great because he realized, or admitted at least, that while he says he, you know, really wants to know truth with a capital T, he admitted that, you know, his small self with a small s admitted that that was pretty shattering to those beliefs that he had in there. And it was a great vulnerable moment for him to admit that. So
it probably would have been really awesome to have been able to administer a personal code evaluation to Einstein. And for what he went through as a kid, if you read his history, when he was in the early grade schools, the teachers told his parents, this boy is a dunce, he'll never make anything of himself, he'll never go anywhere. And I suspect that inadequacy would be a love of self issue, because when somebody is told you're no good, you're never going to make it, you're never going to do anything, even if you do the greatest things in the world, that love of self is inhibited. And until we can crack out the inhibitors, let loose and forgive the inhibitors, then love of self is a difficult thing to get a hold of. And, you know, you look at virtually every great person, and I think you'll find in so many cases when they speak about themselves personally, they speak in terms of their lack of love of self. And until that issue is addressed, it's tough to make the breakout. So I suspect that's what we'd find with Einstein.
Yeah, there's a great episode of Ancient Aliens, one of the shows. I can't remember what cable channel it's on. I think it might be History, but it was called Einstein's Brain. And my friend Albert LaChance had told me like a year ago, he was like, you got to watch it. And what they did was they actually kept his brain, which I hadn't known, but they took slices of his brain, put it under a microscope, and they started analyzing it. And they come to find out that in his seventh and eighth decade, you know, at the time of his death, I'm not sure exactly how old he was when he died, but his brain was like that of a youth. It was like that of an early teenager. And it had this kind of vibrancy to it. And the best thing that they could come to was that he allowed himself to go into the open spaces. The show is amazing. It's like an hour. And they talk about, you know, one of the things about Einstein, Edison was the same, Nikola Tesla was, all three of them were the same in that. And I hear the same about Da Vinci as well, that they would go into these spaces of almost like quasi-meditation. Einstein sometimes called it God time, which I thought was an interesting quote. But they would go into these spaces where their mind was open and it allowed it to blur, much like Joseph Chilton Pierce talks in Magical Child about children having that staring out in the space-time, being able to just be in the open space and not focused in on anything in particular, but it's actually that sort of blurred haze state that allows them to be open, and that's where genius comes through. And they said Einstein spent so much time there that he's, you know, at the time of his death, his brain looked like it belonged to like a 13-year-old, which is pretty stunning if you think about it, considering the stuff that came through that brain. So he was open.
How did that statement of a mind is like a parachute, it only works when it's open?
Yeah. So
the mind that's already decided, it knows the mind of God, and it knows how it all works. I mean, when you start recognizing you put the research in context, here's Harvard that says that in a time frame where 10,000 brain cells fire, you get to see 9 bits of data max, and that in the same time frame, it's estimated there are 2 trillion bits of information potentially available. And to think we really know it all, we know what's going on out there, is pretty amazing.
You know, speaking about this, I actually got a text from Rex, of course, up in Michigan, up in Lansing, earlier this morning about asking for my input on some emails that he had gotten about the Aramaic work, et cetera. And I know he called in, so if you can find him on, if he's got his hand up, it would probably be interesting to bring him on because it just happens to be what we're talking about. With Michael and I never discussed this. It just happened to go this way. So interesting. But I think he's got something probably to put into the conversation that goes right in line with this.
Well, let's check and see if Rex is there. Jeannie, is Rex with us?
Let me see.
517.
Hi, Rex.
Hi, everyone.
Hey, Mayor. So, welcome.
Give me about 5 minutes, if you would, please. I'm out riding my bike, and I'll be back at my house. But I've been listening to the program intently, but I'll be back shortly, and then it'd be better because then you'd be able to hear me better.
Sounds good. Okay, well, just push one when you're ready, Rex.
Cool.
Okay.
Yeah, he had. There was. I was up when I was up in Lansing a couple of weeks ago. I guess something. There was probably my tour manager was inquiring about events up in the area. I'm not sure if he was even if it was even in Michigan, and you know, one of the ministers of one of the places I was at was contacted about. You know, what do you know about this Dale Allen Hoffman guy? What about the Aramaic stuff? And it was an interesting. I was forwarded a couple of emails from a Unity minister. We're just keeping names out, but a Unity minister that had come in with an interesting consensus of the invalidity and the let's just say the lack of credibility of any kind of Aramaic work. It was an interesting email because I actually have it open on my wife's phone in front of me just because there's just a couple of interesting quotes about it because I think it has everything to do with what we're talking about today and that I'm able to be in an open space of the heart as I, you know, sort of respond, responsibly reply to it. There's some interesting things in here. One of the quotes that I see in here is, well, it says someone saying that they've, you know, got an issue with the Aramaic Lord's Prayer that the Lord's Prayer is considered a mixing of biblical teachings and Aramaic. This is an interesting phrase. There's not a credible Bible scholar anywhere in the world who holds the Lord's Prayer in Aramaic in any scholarly regard. I found that as an interesting quote. Another one that I found later down, it actually says, next paragraph.
Let me just throw in, that says more about the person writing it than it does about the Lord's
Prayer. Yeah, I know that. I know. We're going that way. But, yeah, I know you've never heard these before. Absolutely no reputable New Testament scholar, in quotes or in parentheses, that is, one who has earned a doctoral degree in New Testament, is trained in at least Greek, if not also Coptic, Syriac, and Aramaic, publishes in peer-reviewed journals, and participates in academic societies and biblical studies. Thinks of any of the New Testament texts were originally composed in anything other than Koine Greek, which has been put to bed for quite a while now. And, you know, one of the things that I often say in my talks lately, and I've said it on the show before, and I say it tongue-in-cheek, and even though I say it tongue-in-cheek, I actually mean it, which is that I've been telling a lot of audiences lately, I say, I'm not really here for you. You're beyond all hope. No, actually, I don't say that yet. What I usually say is, I'm not really here for you. I'm here for your children. And, of course, they get all creeped out, you know, and then I say, actually, you're somehow beyond hope. I'm just kidding about that. But I tell them I'm here to help us let go so that the young ones can be raised and be educated rather than indoctrinated, rather than, you know, turned into rote information regurgitation systems. And it's one of the things, you know, when Michael talks so much about Moses and the Israelites in the desert, and he talked about how, you know, what's the one thing that had to happen? Of course, you know, they wandered because we know why they wandered. Moses, he's a guy, and men never ask for directions. But they couldn't go in because it said the older generation had to die off, Moses included. And what that really meant is that the older causes that were keeping them from entering the Promised Land, the old beliefs, the old belief systems, the old ideologies, the old temptations, resistance, accusations, hostility, and fear, and judgments, and the old, let's say, corrupt data, as Michael would say, or non-being data, was actually keeping them from the open space of the heart or the present moment. Yeah, and it's an interesting email just because it was so full of errors, and it's a beautiful experience for me to see this. Like, if it was 15 years ago, I would have taken somehow a personal level with it, but it's amazing to be able to see something for what it is and know that it's exactly what Michael said. It's not about the Aramaic teachings, it's about the content of the person's mind that was writing it. But there was there's a few interesting things that were in it. One of the quotes, And my reason, and let me put this out, the reason that I'm in doing this is, I'll say is I know it's a New Thought minister. I don't know who the person is, although it was given to me, but I didn't look at that aspect of it. New Thought will become Old Thought if we don't start reading and studying and continue to keep the heart open. But there's actually a quote here that says that the Hebrew language was a dead language in first century Palestine, which I was really intrigued by. It talked about Koine Greek being the lingua franca of the Roman Empire, which is partially true, not of all Romans, but of many. But it was interesting because one of the things I often hear in my Aramaic work, I'll hear people say, oh, Aramaic, oh, that's a dead language. And I'm like, well, actually, no, it's not a dead language. It's never been a dead language. And what's intriguing to me is, like when I saw that about Hebrew being a dead language in the first century Palestine, first of all, the Hebrew's never been a dead language in Palestine, ever. It's never not been spoken. What was starting to happen around the first century is there was a transition happening from colloquially everyday speaking from Hebrew to what would be called Western or Galilean Aramaic was starting to be, that was more the lingua franca of the poorer class, now the educated or the ones that had the money to go to the state type or the sort of pre-established schools and learning institutions, those people did generally speak Greek. And I found that an intriguing thing because, well, number one, not only was Hebrew never dead in Palestine, it's absolutely an error, but what was most intriguing to me was that there's a theme in the beliefs and the biases that are out there about Aramaic that somehow it was the dopes. Aramaic was spoken by the dopes, the backwater yokels that were idiots that couldn't understand anything. And the thing that I want to pull into that is, okay, well, then what does that say about the man that people point at as the source of all of these, as Yeshua, of course, being from the Galilee, Nazareth specifically, Aramaic was the lingua franca. In places around Judea, and you go to look around Jerusalem and some other places, the commoners were still speaking Aramaic, although it was a slightly different form. It was a little more guttural than the sort of more feminine form that was up in the Galilee. And it's interesting because it was the people that had lots of money that were, you can almost say in the aristocracy, although it wasn't a word that was established yet, within the established patterns of, or the established church, a lot of them were speaking in Greek because they were merging with the Romans, of course. But it's an interesting thing to me because these are decades-old beliefs that have since been nullified for decades now. And I found it intriguing because one of the quotes in the message was actually that this has been put to bed for a very long time now, when in fact it's a very old thought system that didn't allow anything more accurate to come in. You know, the perfect example I give is that when I was in elementary school and high school, I was told, I was talking, you know, a few minutes ago about grammar books, I was told that my English books, the laws of grammar that were in the books were that way because that's the way, that's the laws of English. And I was told there was an E at the end of name because the E makes the A long, and that if you put an E at the end of a word that has a vowel in it, that the E makes the vowel long, which isn't true, actually. There's an E at the end of name because it was originally pronounced Nama. It was not originally pronounced name. And what happened was it was actually a lack of education, a lack of proper knowledge of the history of the English language that had the people, especially of the 20th century. It was a late 19th century and 20th century belief that they literally made laws of grammar up without knowing the actual history of the language and literally lived that belief system and that lie, which is now being turned completely on its ear because we're actually finding out that, you know, the original pronunciations were nothing like that. And what I was saying was when I was in high school and elementary school, I was also told that everything that was in the history books about what we call the American Indian Wars were true. And I was told that what was in those books were true because it was in the newspapers. And I was actually told in elementary school and high school that if you go into the library, go to the microfiche, go to the section with newspaper articles from the 1870s, 1880s, 1890s, and the turn of the 20th century, read those newspaper articles and they'll tell you what happened that day. But I think now, of course, with the internet and media being so ever-present, we're very clear that just because something is on the news media or in a newspaper does not mean that that is what happened. That just means that that's what the reporters wrote down. And it was not until the mid-90s, after I graduated high school, that those history books here in the United States started to be recalibrated with a bit more accuracy, because they started to admit, hey, wait a second, these books are being written based on newspaper articles written by authors, written by newspaper guys back in the 19th century, who reporters who were actually making up incredibly sensational stories about these heathen Indians and all of, you know, the awful blood-sucking Sioux and all these kinds of things, because they knew that, number one, they would get on the wires better that way. They would get on what was what's now called the Associated Press, and of course they'd get more fame and they'd get more money. Interesting, now we actually do know that they were, a lot of these stories that went into the papers that went back to the East from the front, you know, from the frontier, were actually written on the spot to be as intensive and as dramatic as it could, and then that's what people thought was real, and we held that belief for almost 150 years, and it's just now, 150 years later, that we're finding out, hey, wait a second, actually, that's not what happened. This was, of course, we say history is written by those who win, and it's, you know, my concern with the attack on anything, whether it's Aramaic or whether it's homophobia, it's all the same. Whether it's racism, whether it's anti-Semitism, whether it is anti-Islam, whatever it may be, the attack on anything that doesn't come with a personal responsibility of the codes and the belief systems that are already embedded within our non-being self, if it doesn't take that into account and come from that space of conscious, active, present love, from the open space of the heart, it really doesn't matter anymore. We need to be able to move beyond and understand that it's never the information that'll ever be the key. It's that we show up fully in the present moment with the heart open, and we got to realize that these biases are based on things that simply are not true. And if I were to come out and, you know, start picking apart, you know, whatever, a 10-paragraph email, all I'm doing is throwing my belief systems against someone else. I say to everyone again, if you're, like, as an example, if you're running a New Thought church and you're putting out, you're talking about love and peace and presence, then you're going to need to start living that, because the youth, as they start growing older, they're not going to hack that any longer. They're not going to take that sort of the mask-wearing persona of wear the smile on your face and then doing, like, personal attacks and judgments behind the curtain. So, you know, I put that sort of back to Michael in that, you know, I know Michael's seen it 1,000 times, and it's funny that after you see it enough, you start, you know, in the beginning, I was constantly going unconscious and blotto and taking it personally. Now I relish in the fact that I can see that, and it's the mirror, and I'm looking at it, it's all smoke and mirrors, and I'm open to hear what people say. I read books written by atheists. There's a great book I just read this year called Imagine There's No Heaven, a great book written by an atheist, and I loved it because it showed me some of my own blind spots. Keep open, keep love conscious, active, and present, because, again, today's facts are tomorrow's fodder, and just because we already know that the oldest texts that we have, that we actually have in our hands, as far as we know, are Greek ones. Yet we also know, although this has only really been completely unveiled in the last 40 years or so, we know that thousands and thousands of Aramaic documents were burned, including in the burning of the temple in 70 in Jerusalem. We need to stay open and remember, look, let's go to the place where the heart opens. Let's go to the place where there's personal responsibility. And if we're finding that sort of attack and judgment coming through ourselves, realize that what we're doing is we're not living the very thing that we're teaching. So, anyway,
that's just Dale, a little bit of my take. You know, it's an interesting, there's an old idea that says the more things change, the more they remain the same. And you'll notice that in order to get rid of the actual words and teachings of Yeshua 2,000 years ago, they murdered him. The truth, now, there's been a black ops story made up by the Greeks that they murdered him for your sins. And that's just a black ops story. That's just a cover story. The truth is, the people who ran the temple had control, and they had a good thing going. They got the fattest rams, the fattest oxen. they got the cream of the crop from everybody, and they were well fed, and they didn't want anybody to threaten that game. And Yeshua brings truth into their faces, and their stress goes up. They get rid of them because they live in blockage of truth. Now, you look at the average church today in America, and if Yeshua sat down on Sunday morning after the service, he'd get up and say, "That was all Greek to me." And, you know, there's hardly a thought that he actually brought forward that is represented in any true and actual form. But people believe those thoughts, and they believe that it doesn't matter that they believe those thoughts that are in error. They believe that it's okay to believe in error and that you don't have to look at that. And Yeshua, it goes directly against Yeshua, where he says, you must look into your errors in thought and the errors of your society. And so, you know, you got to get rid of truth if you've created a civilization that scams the cream of the crop off of the whole culture with a lie. And that's what happened 2,000 years ago, and it's no different today. I don't anticipate anytime soon that there's going to be a rush of Greek scholars who go, "Oh my God, it was, the man spoke and thought and taught in Aramaic, and we have to go back and understand that," because the average Greek scholar is going to have to go get a job. The average PhD, instead of being a doctorate in theological studies, the average PhD in Greek studies is going to be piled high and deep. It's Greek thought. It's got nothing to do with what Yeshua taught. So get rid of it. They're not going to rush out anytime soon and say, "I guess I'm going to have to go get a shovel and get a job because everything I know is Greek and it isn't accurate." So, you know, that's the reason why I think both of us are moving in the realm of people instead of the realm of academia. You look at the viciousness and the vile action that happens in academia throughout the whole world of academia, and then you bring the teachings to people who are ready to heal, and they use them and they heal. And there'll be those who will still stand back and say, "Well, you know, it just isn't true." Well, you know, I usually suggest to people, don't even believe anything that I'm saying. I'm not here for you to believe me. Here's my suggestion. Take the tool, use it, watch what happens to your mind. And what will happen to your mind is you will remove and delete everything that's a lie. And when you remove and delete, forgive everything that's a lie, then you wake up to the truth. When you wake up to the truth, then you've shifted. And, you know, everybody who shifts stops playing the king's game. And the king doesn't want to lose participants. Now, I don't care whether it's King George or King Obama or, you know, the King of England or whoever it happens to be, whether it's the king of your church. The real teachings of Yeshua show people how, you know, like how many think, you know, you look at the structure in England up to the point of the so-called beloved King James Version of the Bible. You know, I've actually seen bumper stickers say that if it's not in the King James, it's not the Bible. So here's a guy who sits on the top of a pyramid that scams the wealth from every person in the culture. The peons are property. They're owned by the overlords. They pay the bulk of their wealth to the overlord. The overlord pays it to his overlord, who pays it to his overlord, who pays it to his overlord. And finally, it's in the king's hands. You can tell what the people at the bottom of that pyramid were about. You just have to look at what they called them. They were called peons. And that's exactly what was being done. And so, how many actually believe, I mean, in their heart of hearts, how many can actually trick their minds into thinking the guy who's sitting on the top of that pyramid, scamming literally everybody in the country for their wealth, wants to accurately represent the teachings of a man who says, "Know the truth, and the truth will set you free"? I mean, it's a joke on its face. But if one is benefiting from the scam, and one tends to just play along with the scam. And, you know, and so I join with you, Dale, in that we keep bringing this to just John Q. Average, John Q. Public, who's ready to do their work, accurately hand them the work of Yeshua, teach them and support them in doing that, and it will become something that will be unstoppable. It will become eternally available because it's designed to become that.
What a beautiful statement. You know, it has to, because that's truth. You know, it's interesting, too. I hear so many people say, the truth will set you free, which isn't actually what it says. It says knowing the truth, or the gnosis, the direct experience, the direct experiential knowledge of truth will set you free, because you'll realize that you're not your beliefs. You are the open space of love. You know, in the email, there was an interesting little phrase where the minister had said, why would Paul write to Greek speakers in Aramaic? And I found it kind of funny, because that, again, is an ideology that's about 60 years old or so. They really completely leveled and nullified the Lamza Bible, just really totally cut down George and all of the work that he stood for in the email. I'm looking at it going, wow, these people have only read a few books, and they've adopted other people's thoughts rather than actually having their own unique thought, maybe. But they had said that, you know, why would Paul write in Greek? And, of course, what we know is, number one, it was Saul of Tarsus. That was the Paul. And he was a native Aramaic speaker, of course, being from Tarsus. But what's most intriguing is that most, or at least, I shouldn't say most, to be responsible, at least one-third of the letters that are attributed to Paul that are in the Bible today are forgeries. And it's only the absolute cutting-edge open scholarship that was able to let go of the belief systems and the belief of the past, the ideologies and the indoctrination coming from the church and the established seminaries and theological institutions. It was them laying these down next to each other that started uncovering, hey, wait a second, this guy that we call Saint Irenaeus from the late second, early third century, this guy wasn't that much of a saint, actually. He was forging letters in the name of Paul, written in Greek, of course, and saying that they were add-ons to some of Paul's letters and written going to all these different places, all these different locations. But the funny thing about the original Paul letters that you can, I think anybody with an eye, with just a little bit of an eye of an open space, can look through the letters of Paul and see which ones come from an open space of love and the ones that are homophobic and judgmental. It's amazing, because the letters that, you know, someone like Elaine Pagels, who is the thorn in the side of, she comes through indoctrination. Elaine Pagels, Bart Ehrman, who's here in North Carolina, Bishop John Shelby Spong, Marcus Borg, all of these scholars are really frowned upon by, excuse me, the real scholars, or what was the, no reputable scholar was what the minister had said. These scholars that I'm speaking of, Shelby Spong, Bart Ehrman, James Tabor, Elaine Pagels, Marcus Borg, they're frowned upon by real scholars, because they actually are okay with coloring outside the lines. They're okay with not just eating the cereal that's fed, but actually having unique thought and be able to walk off the path that was fed to them and say, wait a second, who says this is the direction that this has to go in? Who says that maybe it wasn't over here? And then we'll go and investigate that. And if you've got these biases that keep the new information, it's like old science always has to die before new science can come in. And the old scientists say, no, this new stuff is awful. This quantum stuff is awful. Superstring theory, it's awful. Higgs boson, God particle, it's awful. It's not real. I don't see the proof. I don't see the evidence. And it happens over and over and over again. And exactly what Michael's saying is that these old belief systems, this old belief, the ideologies, the indoctrination, the non-being sleeping mind has to die. The older generation has to die before we can get into that present moment, the promised land of the open heart, the milk, the honey, the conscious act of present love. And it's a funny thing. Like, as an example, Elaine Pagels has an amazing book called The Gnostic Paul. And there's several books about the Gnostic writings of Paul versus the Irenaeus-led forgeries in the late second century. But it's an amazing thing, because when Elaine writes a book or Bart Ehrman writes a book, and Bart is a great thorn, and Bart's always labeled a an atheist, which he's never once said he was an atheist. All that he's ever said is he doesn't rest his beliefs in any one system of belief in any ideology, and that ruffles the feathers of some people. That makes him a heretic, because he's actually making a choice. And but when Alain's book, Gnostic Paul, came out, and pretty much everything ever released from Bart Ehrman, I see, you know, some interesting fundamentalists, or those sort of dyed-in-the-wool precondition types that went through the pre-established system, they attack them personally. They make personal attacks on Alain Pagel. They make personal attacks on Bart Ehrman. When Bart wrote Misquoting Jesus, some evangelicals wrote a book called Misquoting Jesus. And what was interesting about Misquoting Jesus was Bart's book was full of all kinds of extensive bibliography and textual criticism of where he was getting his information from. When the other book was written about him, there was virtually none of that in there. They weren't backing anything up. And almost the entire book that attacked Bart's book was a personal attack on him, and it had nothing to do with, it wasn't refuting almost anything that he said. Very, very little could they even come up with even an argument for what he was saying. And that's the thing we've got to keep in mind, is that I can talk until I'm blue in the face to, you know, someone about what a giraffe looks like. And if they've never seen an animal with four legs, and they've only ever lived on water, floating in a boat, and all they've ever seen is fish, I can talk about a giraffe until my head explodes. And they're just not going to have any way to catch. Yeah, they're not. It's the perfect example is Michael's, you know, your explanation of the jungles of South America, and this big, huge, shiny bird comes. First, you know, there's that huge animal that comes that rips down all the trees, and then another big animal comes and smashes flat the earth, and then this big shiny bird comes, and people walk out of the bird, and then a few minutes later, you know, people get back in the bird and it flies away. Of course, it's not a bird, it's a plane, but if these people don't have anything that they can categorize that in, that's why I have to bring something like this to light, because I'm telling people, you know, sure, I could easily pick apart every sentence, but I'm less concerned with the information in it, because it's just telling me about the content of the person's mind who wrote it. I'm more concerned, or I'm more, shall I say, focused on keeping my heart open with the condescending, defensive, and offensive, and I don't mean offensive to me, I mean intentionally provocative tone of the email, because what it actually tells me is that whatever this person does believe, obviously the Aramaic work, whether it's Michael's, Rocco's, mine, George Lanza, Neil Douglas Klotz, Andrew Gabriel Ross, Steve Caruso, whoever it may be, obviously we're ruffling their belief systems. And I take that as a great compliment, because it's showing me that, okay, good, because it's that old generation that needs to die off. If they didn't feel offense to me to defend and or attack the Aramaic teachings, then whatever they believe must be accurate. But if it's inaccurate, they're going to need to defend, and they're going to need to be a provocative and offensive. So that's why I can look at something and say, look, we need to bring this into the light and say, judge the tree by the fruit. The, like, lines, when you see something like no reputable New Testament scholar, or there's not a credible Bible scholar anywhere in the world who would fill in the blank, it doesn't matter what you put after that, that's belief systems. That's not where we need to be. We need to be open. In order for science to move forward, we need to be open. In order for art and culture and history and politics and economy and religious ideas and philosophy and spirituality, in order for us to continue to grow, we need to be open. When we lock down, we're dead. It's the non-being mind. It's just the digital creation.
So, Dale,
that's it on the head.
So, Dale, what you're saying is you actually want to live the first law, like you love those who hate you, do good to those who despitefully use you, by maintaining the condition of love and rock in your mind. What a weird thing to do, Dale. But in the meantime,
Jeannie tells me that
we do have Rex on the phone.
I was going to say, that shouldn't matter, though, because, you know, that's Aramaic and Hebrew stuff, and Hebrew was dead at the time, and Aramaic doesn't matter because it was all Greek. So that's the funny thing about making that statement. I love it.
Yeah. You need to send me a copy of this email. I'd love to see it. And Rex is on the phone, Jeannie tells me.
I'll get it to you. It's good.
Cool.
Hi, friends.
Hello.
Hey, young man. I haven't heard your voice in a while.
Great conversation. Thank you, Dale and Michael, and participants for, you know, being able to clarify. So much of what you're saying is so resonant, because I have found myself doing the very things that you were talking about and discussing, Dale, in the past. And that was I would take information that was shared with me because I liked it. And it seemed to be more comfortable for me versus really exploring what's the truth of the information that's being shared. You know, what's the origin? Look at as best I can the facts of the history of what it is and recognize that history is written by historians that, like you said, one or the ones that were writing it the way they liked it and so on and so forth. So taking all that into consideration, it's so important, and the conversation is so important because the part that his that I found, you know, uncomfortable in that because I just don't have the historical background, you know, like you do, Dale. That's why I brought it to you right away, and I was definitely going to send it to Michael as well, but I did it just this morning. But the idea that the person that is doing it is really articulating in such a way that if a person just listens to what they say, it looks like this could be written as a New Testament. You know what I mean? It's like, oh, my gosh. I mean, the person said this and this and this and this and this and this and this. And this is a fact and this is why it's a fact and everybody else is an idiot and only this. And all of a sudden that, and if I don't listen from an objective view of love, then I will allow my own bias to determine what I'm reading versus
you just hit it right on the head. That's right on the head. Most people don't get that. That's why I'm so thankful of knowing Michael and coming through that perspective, because if I didn't have that, I'd have nothing. I'd have absolutely nothing, really, truly.
And you do that really well. I so enjoyed getting to know you, and I'm continuing to marvel at the, you know, the pleasure of having you in my life and getting to know you. And Michael, you already know all this, and I'm saying this today because I haven't said it to him specifically. But the idea that you bring forth a refreshing system of viewing principles, viewing truth, viewing the scriptures, viewing Yeshua's teachings, it's refreshing in that it helps me maintain my own integrity of doing my own work and my own research, not just accepting what you're saying or what Michael's saying, but looking into it further and saying, okay, well, Dale said this, and let me look at do a little research, and oh, and then allow Ruka to interpret it for me. And if I do that, when I do that, not if, but when I do that, I find that there's a state of peace that comes from within me that is beyond what appears to be an attack or appears to be judgment. And then it just, it's like an acceptance of what a person is just, it looks like they're writing what they're coming from their own mind. They according to what you're saying and what I actually had an inclination of, much of what they were saying was just their own bias and based on their own fears of looking deeply into their own process inside.
Tell you what,
so thank you.
We're going to have to interrupt the conversation because we're down to a minute or so, and I would like to hear what Dale's got coming up on his calendar really quickly. If you've got anything happening, Rex, and of course tonight we're going to be at Unity of Wilmington doing Laws of Living, Still Point Breathing tomorrow, and the service on Sunday. Dale, what's happening on your calendar?
Briefest version, my website's DaleAllenHoffman.com. I'm in Wilmington. Or excuse me, you said Wilmington. I'm in Williamsburg, Virginia, tomorrow and Sunday. And then I've got Annapolis, Maryland, Princeton, New Jersey, Haddon Township, New Jersey, Cleveland, Ohio, Atlanta, Georgia, Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. So the details are all on my website.
Cool. Well, so much for Florida then. Are we going to still get to connect there? We'll have to
I'll be in Florida in January and February. Quite a bit, actually, several weeks, and I'll get with you on that, yeah.
Okay, we'll connect. Do you have anything happening, Rex, to announce? Got about 5 seconds.
No. We're good, thank you.
Okay, blessings. Have the best year yet of your eternal life. Bring us straight to the show Monday. Take care.